This is Fran Bernford in the second session, in which we're addressing worship, the liturgy, and social justice. And I want to again begin by calling to your attention some books, some of which are over in the bookstore, that I really encourage you to take a look at. And let me ask, did any of you who were here the last time bring back this little piece? How many of you are here for the first time today? We'll pass these around. Take one, and if you didn't bring it back, take another and leave it, if you don't mind leaving the second one. We'll just keep them going around until everyone has one, and then you can set them back here. A very good book, and not at all difficult to wrestle with, is Liturgy and Social Justice. This one, it may have sold out over at the bookstore. It has been here at Holden prior to my arrival and has been one of the favorites, so it's apparently the stock has gone down quickly. But it's listed in the bibliography in the back of this book. The author is Mark Searle, or I should say the editor, because there are several writers. He is a Catholic person, priest, and it does a very fine job on the topic that I've been addressing of liturgy and social justice. Another piece, if there are any pastors in here today who weren't here last time, or worship leaders, again, I want to recommend Hessel's Social Themes of the Christian Year. It is the first time that a book has come out which takes the lectionary and draws out all of the social themes to help and encourage our pastors to build their their sermons around that. Another one that I want to call your attention to is the Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, which also is over in the bookstore. How many of you have used this book in your congregations? Have any of you? If you have any interest, oh, good, in knowing how far have the mainline churches now come in their agreement, in agreement in understanding of baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. This is a statement from a long series of sessions of the mainline Christian churches, including the Catholic Church is not reflected here. But it's very interesting and fascinating to see how close we are now in our agreement, in our understanding of the sacraments. And it is also very interesting, to see that churches such as Presbyterian and Methodist are becoming much, much more liturgical than they were a few years ago, and much closer to a Lutheran understanding of the sacraments. Well, yes?
This is not on your subject exactly, but I was just going to say, in relation to that, I know the Tacoma, I think it was just the Tacoma and the area that was around it, had a real neat thing this last year where they had, they put on a videotape of representation from Eastern Orthodox and Catholic and Methodist and one of the three churches in the Lutheran discussing this book. And then there were small groups throughout the churches,
yes,
combinations of churches all together. And although it wasn't terribly well attended, I thought it was really neat. You could really talk with lots of different people from different churches. It's really just a neat thing.
Ever since Vatican II a number of years ago, there has been an enormous increase in dialogue going on ecumenically. And so the current very popular dialogues are around baptism, Eucharistian ministry, and I think you should go back to your churches and encourage your pastors to have a series of study sessions on this, preferably with other ecumenical churches in the area, mainline churches. Okay, those are the ones I wanted to mention as we get started today. The way I want to carry out today's session is to spend some time on looking at the implications of the Lenten season in terms of moral responsibility, and then to have some dialogue and then move into Easter and the liberating aspects of Easter and how that's reflected in our liturgy. This summer in the worship conferences, the scriptures that were used around discussing moral responsibility in Lent focused on the story of the prodigal son. But today I want to share a parable with you that is based on experiences from my childhood and relates to the story of the woman who wept at Jesus' feet, washed his feet with her hair, and was such a shocking thing for the Pharisees who were there to observe this. Lily was her name, and Lily taught me the meaning of grace. The little girls in our Sunday school class, there were six of us that were very close friends. And we could not understand, nor would anybody explain to us, why it was that none of the adults would ever speak to Lily, and they wouldn't allow we children to speak to her either. She sat all alone every Sunday in a pew by herself. She was never allowed to come to Holy Communion, and she was simply a totally isolated person. We couldn't understand why the adults in the congregation referred to her as a woman of sin, but we were really fascinated with what that must mean. We would ask our Sunday school teacher, and she'd say we weren't old enough to understand what that meant, that when we were older, then we would understand. So we looked for clues, and we found one in our King James Bibles. It was on page 133 of the New Testament, and it was a picture, those kind of pictures that they used to have in the King James editions for children. And it showed this scene of Jesus dressed in this dazzling white robe with his golden hair and bright blue eyes. And behind Jesus, there were standing the elders, or rather, they were standing the Pharisees. And at Jesus' feet was this beautiful woman. And she was there in a crimson robe, kneeling at his feet, weeping. Her long golden hair came clear down to her hips in the picture. She looked like Rita Hayworth to us. In our Baptist Sunday school, we children weren't allowed to go to movies, but we'd seen pictures of Rita Hayworth, and the woman of sin looked like Rita Hayworth. We were impressed with the way those Pharisees in the background were glaring at the woman of sin and glaring at Jesus, and we took them to be the elders in our Baptist church, because the elders in our church always stood at the end of the pew when communion was being served and glared at we children to make sure that we didn't sneak a piece of the Wonder Bread, which they'd take Wonder Bread and they'd cut off a crust and cut it in little cubes, and it looked so good. But we weren't, of course, allowed to have any, nor was Lily. they also stood at the end of her pew and glared at her to make sure she didn't take any. So now we had a clue. We weren't sure why either the lady in the picture or Lily were called woman of sin, but you know, we understood now that at least there was some sort of connection. And our favorite game to play became woman of sin. We would play woman of sin every Sunday, every day at school out on the playground. And we developed these scenarios to try to help us understand why this woman was a woman of sin. She, by the way, was also beautiful. She didn't look like any other woman in the church. She wore high heels. She had rouge. She wore lipstick. She had beautiful hair, permed hair, unlike anyone else. So, I'll tell you what our scenarios were. You can see how close you think we were to understanding the meaning of woman of sin. Our first scenario was that that Lily had been seen coming out of a Saturday night dance at the Mormon temple. Our second scenario was that she had been seen coming out of the state-controlled liquor store with a little bag all wound round tight at the top. But our third scenario was the really bold one. It took a lot of crusty nerve on the part of we little girls to even do this. Here's what it was. She had been seen coming out of the Roman Catholic Church. Well, what happened there was that Sunday after Sunday, Lily was ignored and isolated and disenfranchised. But on Wednesday nights, which was prayer meeting, attendance grew in hopeful anticipation that Lily would stand up in front and really confess her sins. And Lily did. Every Wednesday night, she would stand up and she would say, "Through the grace of God, I've been given new life in Christ. And I thank God for my new life." And then she'd sit down, and everybody would be kind of disappointed. Well, one Sunday morning, Lily got up from her pew, and she marched right down to the front of the church. And she turned around, and she said to the congregation, "You people are not at all interested in my new life in Christ. All you're interested in is my old life, and hearing about my old life and wallowing in my old sins. And I'm going to leave this place and go to a church where people will celebrate my new life." And so she walked out. Well, we little girls got together during the week. The next week was going to be Communion Sunday. And we made a pact with each other. And we were really frightened about what we planned to do. But the following Sunday morning, when the communion tray came down the row where we were sitting, we made sure that we sat in a row in the middle where there were adults on both sides of us so that it would have to go by us, even though the elders stood at the end of the row and glared at us. When it came by us, each one of us took not one but two pieces of Wonder Bread, of Holy Communion, one for ourselves and one for Lily. Because somehow, even though we were little kids, we understood, or we somehow had caught a glimpse of grace and knew that it wasn't Lily's sin that had so frightened the adults. It was her faith. Saint and sinner at the same time is what we are. Broken vessels, yet new wineskins. And as in the story of the prodigal son or daughter, forgiving parent, prodigal child, or jealous, arrogant, boastful sibling, I at least am each of these, and yet even though I am each of these at some time. Always I am the beloved and forgiven child of God. And yet, sometimes, often, I'm afraid to be what God has called me to be. God has called me and called you to be God's reconciling agents in this world. We're to be God's shalom people in a hurting and broken world. And then we wonder, or at least I wonder, if God is so all-wise and so infinite, why would God call this voice to be a spokesperson for the gospel, the good news, liberation? And yet, day after ordinary day and week after ordinary week, you and I are called and then provided with the help we need in order to be God's reconciling agents in the world. I have come to believe that first and foremost, what we need comes to us through worship. First of all, in worship, and you'll notice that when you walk into Vespers tonight, in worship is, first of all, the symbol of our baptism, the reminder of our baptism, because it's in baptism that you and I have been named and claimed and given an identity, called to be God's reconciling agents. And then there is the Eucharistic meal, in which we come together, and in the breaking of the bread, our eyes are opened, and we realize who we are and whose we are. We experience the community. We're fed and nourished, sent out to be God's people. Now, then the word comes to us in the lessons, in the sermon. And week after ordinary week, the story of God's mighty acts is reenacted for us, with us, and by us. The liturgy presupposes a group of people who can reach across social and economic and political barriers and strange structures in the world and speak of themselves as we and say, I believe. And yet, we know that the worshiping community, even in its liturgical manifestations, is unable to be the perfect community that the liturgy would imply we are supposed to be. In fact, we know only too well, unless your congregation is different than all the congregations that I know, that the local congregation reflects generally not the justice of the kingdom, but the division of social groupings. And that's the tension that then is confronted when the Christians assemble in worship. But the tension must be retained, because justice is a mark of the church. That's an important enough sentence to say again. Justice is a mark of the church, just like being one holy Catholic apostolic church. Justice is also a mark of the church. And like the other qualities that I've just mentioned of one holy Catholic and apostolic, justice constitutes a tension in the church. We are one. The Christian church is one. It is one because God has said that we are one. And yet, we are many. We are broken in our oneness into many different churches, some of which will have nothing to do with one another. We are holy because God has said we are a holy people, and yet we know that many times we fail to be holy. And We are called to be just, and yet we know we fall short of that. But we shouldn't try to get rid of the tension. In fact, we should remember every Sunday when we worship that the purpose of worship is not to make all in attendance feel happy, comfortable, and safe. The purpose of worship is not to please everybody that is there with the kind of worship that we do. There are congregations who make it their prime concern to keep adjusting and changing and redoing the liturgy with the hope that someday they'll come up with something that will please everyone. And it is my bias that I share with you now that that is not the purpose of worship at all. Rather, the purpose, first purpose of worship is to praise our Creator God. It is to proclaim and realize the saving presence of the Spirit in the world. It is to bring the presence of the kingdom in among the people of God. And in the celebrating of the liturgy, it is to help us learn to recognize justice and injustice when we see it. In fact, though that is not its primary purpose, the liturgy serves as a basis for social criticism by giving us a criterion by which we can evaluate the events and structures of the world. But it is not just the world out there that needs to be evaluated or that stands under the judgment of God's justice. Rather, first, the church itself is accused. In the degree to which it fails to recognize what it is about, what it is to be doing in terms of being God's reconciling agents, the church eats and drinks condemnation to itself. One of the main themes of Lent is the theme of power and powerlessness. And I want to begin our first dialogue today by asking you to share some examples with one another and with me of areas in your life where you hold power over others, or institutions you're a part of which hold power over others. Who can come up with an idea? Where is a place in your life where you hold power over others?
Over children.
Over children. Parents over children. We're not making a judgment here that power is bad. We're saying power is where somebody else can make someone else do something they don't want to do.
Teachers over students.
Parents over children. Okay. Are you a teacher?
Yes.
Okay. Because I'd like you to be giving examples from your life where you hold power over others or are, or maybe you're a student. Yes. Other examples?
Employer, employee.
Okay. Yeah. If you're an employer, you hold power over those who depend on you for their paycheck or for keeping their job.
Medical professionals over those they hope to help.
Are you a medical professional? Okay. Medical professionals over, can I say patients?
Mm-hmm. Press and the public.
The press over the public. Mm-hmm.
Government officials over everyone.
All right. Government officials or even the government. Government officials over the people. Anybody here pay taxes? You know that feeling. Other examples where you hold
church over its members.
Church over members. Here, what do you mean by church? Local congregation or institution of the church or what?
Well,
I didn't hear where that came, see where that came from.
Came from up here.
Oh, okay.
Well, I was thinking in terms of, for instance, the Catholic Church wields a lot of power as an institution as on the issues of birth control and so on.
Okay.
But I think your local church wields power. I mean, your case of Lily.
Yes, all right. Church over members, and sometimes can that be reversed?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
All right, members over church. If you don't think so, try being a pastor sometime in a church that pays your salary. Mm-hmm. All right.
Officers of the law over criminals.
All right. Now, I'm real anxious that we get as close to personal as possible here.
The supervisor or subordinates?
Okay. Supervisor over subordinates, yeah.
It's a salary continuation program.
Yes, right. How about, are there spouses who have control over spouses? Wife over husband, husband over wife?
It's not equal, 50-50?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes it probably isn't.
Well, even if it is, there's still power.
Right. Is that misspelled?
Yes.
Been divorced too long. The only power I have is over misspelling it. Others that you might want to, where you hold power over someone else.
Friends sometimes hold power over each other if they want to please each other.
Okay, a friend to a friend.
We hold power over the wealth of the world as consumers.
Okay.
How we spend, choose to spend our money.
All right. Now I'm going to push you into thinking personally. Just let's be quiet for a moment while you think of a situation in your life where someone else holds power over you. I just want you to think about that for a moment. We're not going to put this up on the board, but is there a situation in your own life where another person or institution holds enough power over you that it is not comfortable? Now, without getting into the specific situation, what are some of the feelings that one has when one is in a situation of feeling powerless or as if you do not have control over your own destiny? Yes.
Frustration
is certainly one.
Trying,
yes.
Change something, no one else wants to go along with it.
Yes.
Supervisors are up and down the ladder.
Okay. Certainly frustration.
Policy changes and things like that.
Frustration. Another other words.
Anger.
Anger.
Fear.
Fear.
Loss of self-esteem. Depression.
Depression, which is tied to anger. Depression is unexpressed anger usually.
Anger.
Yeah. Grief. Grief? Did I hear grief? Why? Say a little more about grief.
Sense of loss.
Okay.
Also loss of self-esteem again.
Okay. What are some of the things we've heard? Fear and anger. What's even stronger than anger sometimes if it gets bad enough?
Hatred
and rage. Depression. Loss of self-esteem.
Helplessness.
That's a terrible feeling, to feel helpless and out of control.
Trapped in a, you know, that depression thing too. No option, no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Depression.
I think if if we had the time, you know, to really contemplate and reflect on this, probably just about everyone in the room would be able to remember a situation in their life or a time in their life. It could even be a medical matter that that something happens to you, a heart attack or surgery or something that puts you in the situation of being a helpless one. You feel as if you're under the power of the health professionals who are going to save you or not. It's a terrible thing to feel out of control, powerless and helpless over your own life. And one of the things that we need in our culture to remember is that large parts of the world, especially the third world, go through life feeling totally powerless and helpless and out of control to have any say about their own destiny. And it's important as we're considering the liturgy as it relates to social justice, that when we gather as a worshiping community, those brothers and sisters in Christ, because many of the third world are Christian, and those who are not Christian but are still the children of God, are living day after day after day in a situation to be God's reconciling people in the world. God's people who do whatever we can, both individually and as a community, to heal the brokenness in the world. This is what our Lutheran liturgy, among other things, is all about. I want to again refer briefly and ask you in your books, the books I gave to you, to turn to page 35. Remember last time we were together, we read together some statements from this Worship Among Lutherans, which is from the Lutheran World Federation. The complete study is available in the bookstore, I think. If not, you can order it yourself directly from the Lutheran World Federation. I'm going to read a little bit from 10 again and then a couple of the others. I'm reading now from number 10. This is to remind us that the baptized people of God gather for worship in a broken world plagued by hunger, addiction, despair, alienation, divided by political, economic, and racial ideologies, scarred by the Holocaust and other genocides, oppressed by tyranny, wounded by torture and war, and overshadowed by the threatening cloud of nuclear catastrophe. That's a terrible picture that was painted in those words. But here is the Easter message coming through. In such a world, Christians gather for worship, affirming the wonder and goodness of God's creation and acknowledging thereby God as creator and sovereign. In spite of whatever is going on in the world, we as Christians have reason to gather together on Sunday and celebrate. Sunday morning is Easter. You all know that, don't you? Luther said, every Sunday is a little Easter. When we gather on Sunday, it's a celebration, celebrating that despite all the brokenness in the world, God is still in charge. Even if we sometimes in ourselves deny or feel in a state of despair, the truth, whether we or the rest of the world are ready to admit it or not, God is still in charge. Because in 11, through the ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the incarnate Son, God restored hope, dignity, and purpose to the whole human community, indeed to creation itself. Established in baptism, the Christian community finds itself in the midst of the world, existing for the sake of the whole creation. The church does not exist for itself. Sometimes we forget that. the church, our local congregations, are not there to exist for themselves and their own edification. We, by God's grace, through Jesus Christ, have been assured of our salvation. We now exist for others. And then let's, this is all worth reading, and I hope that you will, but turn again over to number 14. I'll teach a new word to some of you here, I'll bet. It was a new word for me. In its worship, the assembly participates proleptically. That means in anticipation, proleptically, in God's promised future. Because each Sunday that we worship, we are looking not only back at the first advent of Christ, but looking forward to the second advent. And thus we bear witness prophetically to God's will for the world. Each time we worship, we are not just coming together to have a warm, fuzzy time together. We come together to worship, to remember God's mighty acts, and to be a sign in the world that God is still in charge. And here again is why in the Lutheran Church, trying to again be faithful to what Martin Luther's intention was and those of the other reformers, the Lutheran Church is moving toward, for example, more frequent celebration of the Eucharist. It was Martin Luther's intention and that of the other reformers that the Eucharist would be celebrated each Sunday and in addition to that on all festivals. Because in the words of the institution, Jesus said, "As often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you do so in remembrance of me." And when we gather together around Holy Communion, we are celebrating, remembering, and looking forward to the great and promised feast which will come. Then let's look at 15 for just a moment. We read this last time, but this is one of the hard things for Christians to remember. When we gather for worship to celebrate the reign of God in a broken world, it is to admit that we as Christians contribute to that brokenness. We can and we do participate in the world's evil. That's another very somber statement to remind ourselves of. That we are not some holy people that are not part of the problem. The hope for the world is in Christ, in God, not in us. We ourselves are part of the problem, and it's only where God uses us, where the gifts of the Spirit within us are set free to be God's reconciling agents, that we become more than just part of the problem. Okay, I hope that you will have a chance to look more at that, because I just must move on to take a look at some of the themes of Easter for a moment. And I'm going to take the time here to share with you a short story which takes place in a prison in Central America. It's Easter Sunday. Okay? The setting is the story is true. The setting is Central America. The characters are without hope in this world, and it's Resurrection Sunday. What is it like to be totally helpless and hopeless and under the power of someone else? See what comes through to you in this. Today is Resurrection Sunday. my first Easter in prison. Will it be my last, or will there be others like this? Imprisonment is much harder to bear when you don't know how long it will last. The political situation is becoming worse and worse. Bits and pieces of news reach us by various means, telling how the horizon is darkening for our country. What will they do with us? There is no optimistic answer, but everyone is trying not to create an atmosphere of depression. Surely the regime can't continue to keep almost 10,000 political prisoners in its jails, because the contact between soldiers and prisoners could be fatal for the government. Both soldiers and prisoners are being shown a perspective on the economic, political, and social situation which they had not known before. In here, it's become much easier to understand how men and women in the Bible felt, stripping themselves of everything that was superfluous. Here, every day brings new worries, for we have lost everything. We have heard that our homes have been lost. We have heard our families are broken up. Our children are wandering in the streets. Our spouses are also imprisoned. And on this Resurrection Sunday, what does the resurrection of Jesus Christ have to say to us? It's strange, but in this kind of situation full of uncertainty and destitution, the religious experience acquires a resonance which I had never experienced before. For here we have nothing but our faith. Our very lives are precarious and uncertain. But Christ rose from the dead, and today is Easter Sunday, and it is an appropriate moment to take a critical look back over my own life. I have had the opportunity to serve as a pastor in some 15 churches, and yet I feel that here in this prison, my congregation is my fellow prisoners. I'll skip forward to where he says, our belongings have been confiscated and not returned to us. All we have is our camp beds with no bedding, the clothes we are wearing, and not even a single cup. We want to celebrate the Eucharist because it is Easter Sunday, and yet we have no cup, we have no bread, we have no wine. I call together my congregation of prisoners, and we say that we will have communion without bread and wine. It will be a communion of empty hands, a communion of captives, a communion of the exiles and the oppressed. Never before had we experienced so clearly the weight of eternity erupting in our historical time. The prisoners among us who were not Christians said, "We will talk quietly so you can meet." They formed an informal group close to the guards and provided the curtain of ordinary conversation which allowed we Christians to concentrate. For too dense a silence would have drawn the guards' attention as surely as the lone voice of the preacher, and we had been warned that any meeting which was not simply for ordinary informal conversation would be severely punished. I began my sermon. We have no bread, no water, no wine, but we'll act as though we had. Like when we were kids, said one boy of 12. He was a member of a team of militants who had been condemned to 30 years of prison. In my town, we used to play at being visitors, and we would drink water for hours on end. It'll be just like that, I answered him. You know that Christ asks us to act out of the simplicity of children. Near one of us, one of the prisoners sitting on a camp bed kept a cautious eye on the guard, ready to warn us should the barred door, which we couldn't see, open. Christ will accept our celebration, commented one of the new brothers who had the task of passing the word about the service. It doesn't matter that we don't have the right things. What matters is that we do it with sincerity. "This meal in which we take part," I said, "reminds us of the prison and death and torture, and yet final victory and resurrection of Christ Jesus. He asked us to remember him by repeating this act of fellowship. And the bread which we do not have today, but which is present in the Spirit of Jesus Christ, is the body which he gave for humanity. The fact that we have none represents very well the lack of bread and the hunger of so many millions of people. And when Jesus distributed bread among his disciples, or when he fed the people, he revealed the will of God that all should have bread. The wine, which we do not have today, is Jesus' blood present here among us in our faith. Poured out for us, it will help us move toward freedom. God made all men and women one in his blood. It says so in the Bible. I ask if any comrades wish to say something. A man of about 60 whose daughter had died fighting with the guerrillas said, "I think this communion means that our dead are alive. They have given their bodies and their blood, making Christ's sacrifice their own. I believe in the resurrection of our dead, and I believe their presence among us." There was a silence which no one dared to break. "This is a communion," I said after a moment. "Not only a communion among us here, but a communion with all the brothers and sisters in the church on the outside. Not only with those who live, but with those who have died. Still more, a communion with those who will come after us, who will be faithful to Jesus Christ." I held out my empty hand to the first person on my right and placed it over his empty hand. And I said, "Take and eat. This is the body of Jesus given for you." We raised our empty hands to our mouths and received the body of Jesus in silence. "Take and drink the blood of Jesus given for you," we said to one another as we raised the cup which was not there, filled with the wine we did not have. Then we gave thanks to God and finally stood up and embraced each other and passed the peace of Christ. And then I said to my fellow prisoners, "Christ is risen." And they answered, "He is risen indeed." How many of you will still be here on Sunday when we gather for Eucharist together as a community here at Holden? I think it would be so good if we could remember, and those of you who return to your homes at your next Holy Communion, remember as we gather around the Eucharist all the people in the world who gather under the kinds of conditions that are described here. The thing that touches me in this story is they had nothing, and yet they celebrated Easter, understood the hope that comes to us in Easter. In a little closing dialogue, one of the things to think about in relation to the liturgy in the Easter season is, who is it that we are keeping out of our worship? Who are the lilies in your congregation? Who are the outcasts which would not feel welcome or part of your worship? To be fully included means that a person can worship, can commune if they are at least of the age of communing, could hold office. Let me name some kinds of people and think in your mind, would these people be fully included in worship, feel fully a part of the family. How about an undocumented person? If you come from the part of the country where I do, California, or if you're from Arizona, or maybe on the East Coast, you may have people coming to your congregation sometime who are not citizens and in fact are more commonly called illegal aliens. The church prefers the term undocumented person. A divorced clergy person. An elderly person. How are the elderly people treated in your congregation? How about a former convict? An alcoholic? How about a divorced man? Will he be fully welcome? Will he be a full part of the community? A divorced woman? A lesbian? A 16-year-old person. Is a 16-year-old able to hold office in your congregation? A prostitute. How about a migrant worker if you're in an upper middle class congregation? Will a migrant worker who wanders in with his or her family feel welcome and a part of the? How about a black professor or physician or attorney? How about a very poor person of color? A wealthy person of a different ethnic background? A physically handicapped person, will he or she be able to have easy access to your congregation and be fully involved in the worship life? How about an unmarried couple living together? A radical feminist who's pushing her views on everyone? Will the congregation be able to recognize the gifts that she is bringing, the vision that she is helping to open up, or will she be turned out or off? Who is it that may not be welcome in your congregation? Jesus reached out to the outsiders. He made a special effort to find out who the outsiders were, including the lily, and make them feel not only welcome, but bring them into his circle. Let's hear any comments from the group. Do we have people here from congregations where all of the groups I mentioned or others, are there any problems?
Well, I come from a congregation where we have colored. In fact, our school principal is a colored person. He's a wonderful man.
Okay. Well, okay. I want to hear if there are from any who feel that there are people who might find it difficult to be fully received into the life of your congregation. No problems here.
I would think that anyone that's illegal would not be welcome.
Okay.
I'm not speaking for my church, I'm speaking for myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But how would we know if they were illegal? I'm from California also, and we have quite a few Hispanics in our church.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know if they're...
Well, it may be that you don't know, but we also have Lutheran congregations who... have declared themselves sanctuary churches, and there are many people worshiping in their midst who are known to be undocumented. Well, anybody else have a comment here?
Yeah. Welcome in the congregation that's all of these people are welcome to attend. Some of these people, I would say, would not be invited into membership. Some of these people would not be considered for officers, to be officers of the church. Undocumented person, I don't know how I'd respond to that. That's a problem with the laws of our local society, and I don't believe the church needs to directly get involved with that, though I believe we should not violate the laws of society, which means we shouldn't go out of our way to protect an undocumented person. But then again, I'd be hard-pressed to turn over such a person to be deported. Divorced clergy can be a member of the church, can be a clergyman person. I think it's appropriate for a church council to look closely at where is that person's walk today with the Lord. Elderly person has equal rights. Socialist, I guess, has equal rights, though. We'll run into conflict at the social level. A former convict, if he's a former convict, he or she, then that's not an issue. A racist, that would be an issue. Anybody who's a racist is certainly preaching against God's word. I do not know whether my church would object to such a person holding office.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there.
Okay.
And ask, you've gone down the list, and I appreciate that, but I want to see if anybody else, you're going down the list.
Yes.
Are there any comments from anyone else? Or am I sensing here, because there are none, that you feel that there are no categories of people, except as the two of you have mentioned, that would not feel welcome in their
worship? I was surprised that there were so many, that I do have single or several instances of those people being represented in our congregation. I think that's a change from 10 years ago. I think 10 years ago there were no blacks and not as many single parents and not as many diverse people as there are now. But I think there's still some resistance. I think there'd be trouble for the homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
I think there'd be trouble for the poor people. The very poor would feel out of place and would not be comfortable in our church.
Any other comments? Thanks for your comments. Yes.
I would think that many of these people would not feel comfortable in certain congregations, and that they would look for congregations who would, just by their makeup, they would feel more comfortable in themselves.
Okay.
And
because the time is about up, and they're very strict in their directions to us that we end on time. What I would like to do is encourage you to, these are yours to take away. If you have one already, leave the one you took today. And if you come to my last session on Saturday, I guess it is, please bring it back with you. But I would urge you to think about the fact that that our congregation, or your congregation, my congregation, what are we doing in the interest of following the model of Jesus, who considered it his particular mission to seek out the outcasts? He loved to attend the temple and was an active person in his own temple, and in fact referred to as rabbi. But he made it his ministry to go out and seek the outcasts. There was no one that was not welcome to come and sit at the feet of Jesus. And so wherever our congregations decide that there are categories of people that aren't welcome for some reason or other, or decide to conduct our worship life in such a way, which I think is probably true of all of our congregations and true of most of us individually, so that people, because of who they are, will not feel welcome, to that extent, we fall short, I believe, of meeting the ministry to which we've been called. It's something to think about. I'm reflecting my own bias here, obviously. And I have already said at the beginning that I fall short. But in closing, thank you very much for being with me today. Enjoy God's beautiful creation, and I hope I'll see some of you on Saturday.